agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm feeling like I've just been released from my conservatorship.
Freedom
reigns.
I was hoping you were going to do that one. Yeah, now Brittany can listen to the show all by her own volition if she's there. You know, Brittany, hi, how you doing? Congratulations.
Yes.
But anyway, before we get started, I wanted to mention something very briefly. If you happen to notice in the near future a sort of mini episode sort of thing in the podcast feed, that do not be alarmed. This is a little thing we're doing when we occasionally come across podcasts that we really like. It's sort of a brief intro sort of thing. You might have seen other kind of big brand name podcasts do the same thing. Well, we're getting in on that as well. And so if that pops up in your feed, it is no cause for alarm and just a thing we're trying out. So anyway, just wanted to pass that along. Another thing I wanted to pass along is what we will be talking about today, and we have a lot to talk about today. We have a sort of late-breaking story, a Fifth Circuit ruling on the vaccine, the OSHA vaccine mandate. We have a lot to talk about with inflation, which is once again up, a federal appeals court blocking the January 6th committee request for Trump documents related to, well, January 6th, a federal judge saying that the Texas mask mandate ban violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, backlash against House Republican infrastructure bill supporters that got pretty rough, actually, and if we have time, some thoughts about a brand new university, and maybe some thoughts about Pew Research Center's latest political typology. Both Jay and I have taken that test for that, and some kind of surprising results, and maybe some issues we have with it as well. So that is a lot to cover, and as always, we will not get to all of that on the regular show, and so that will be there on the bonus show for Patreon supporters. And if you are not a Patreon supporter, to become one, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to get that weekly extra show that comes out right at the same time as the regular show, but you're not able to financially support the show, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. And we also are happy to take your money, not just on Patreon, but on PayPal or on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. And to see all those options, you just go to politicsguys.com/support. And so we will get right in with our first story after just quick break. Okay, Jay. So I actually have to give kudos to you for letting me know about this late breaking story. It might not have made it in time for me to put together my sort of preview of it or summary of it. And so thanks for it. It's really kind of, it's late breaking in a way, but it's not, because on November 6th, which was just after you and I did last week's podcast, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals halted the implementation of the of OSHA's rule requiring employers with 100 or more employees to ensure that their workers are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or that they test negative for the virus at least once a week. And that emergency stay then was granted pending briefing and expedited review by the court. Well, late yesterday, November 12th, the Fifth Circuit reaffirmed that stay, but in a longer opinion that I would say made their view of the merits of the case crystal clear. In his 22-page opinion for the unanimous three-judge panel, Judge Kurt D. Engelhardt, a Bush appointee to the federal bench who recently was a few years ago was appointed to the appeals court by President Trump, noted that under the traditional stay standard, a court considers four factors: whether the stay applicant has made a strong showing he's likely to succeed on the merits, whether the applicant will be irreparably injured absent the stay, whether issuance of a stay will substantially injure the other parties interested in the proceeding, and finally, where the public interest lies. And they concluded that all of those factors favored a stay in this case. Now, after Jay alerted me to that ruling yesterday evening, I started to read it, and my assumption going in was that the OSHA rule was probably a bit of a stretch, but I was inclined to give the agency the benefit of the doubt, as I believe courts should and generally actually do in these cases. But after reading the opinion, I came away believing not only that the OSHA regulation was clearly overly broad, but that it was outside of the scope of the agency's authority in any case. And even, and this is what surprised me most maybe, even if Congress had specifically authorized the OSHA measure or just itself passed legislation saying this, that it might not have been within Congress's power to even do that. And I got to say, I was not expecting that. So, Jay, you're the attorney here, obviously. So I thought we could start off by you explaining what the court held and, what you thought about it.
Sure. And after reading the opinion, Mike immediately went online and ordered a MAGA hat. He's like, finally saw the light. I agree with what Judge Engelhardt and the rest of the court wrote there, in that this is something that is new and sweeping and much bigger than anything that OSHA could have been expected to regulate or control through its organic statute. On the procedural basis of this, now there's some other weird stuff going on here, and this is really in the this is like the high level advanced class here. So, Mike, you have set out the standards for a stay. It's essentially the same as an injunction. And what we had before was this emergency motion to issue a stay, which is kind of like, and again, the terminology is not exact, but it's in effect the same thing, what they call in courts a temporary restraining order, which is the one side rushes into court and says, court, you got to stop this right away. We don't even have time to have a hearing on it, which is what the court did last week. And then they said, okay, but we're going to get this hearing on the briefs as soon as possible. And then what you have secondarily is what's called the preliminary injunction order, which is a somewhat on the merits, right? There's some presentation of arguments or evidence when needed. And you get a sense of where the court's going on whether there's irreparable harm and whether who's likely to succeed on the merits. It's not a final judgment on the merits, but in most cases, right, it gives you a pretty clear idea of where the court is, and it's unlikely, it's unusual, very unusual for a court to say this is unlikely to succeed on the merits as a matter of law, right? There's no new evidence that's going to come in that's going to change something. And then, at a later date say, well, no, now we think we're reversing that and we don't think it wins on the merits. The complicating and weird factor in this is there have been lawsuits filed against the mandate all over the place. In some cases, almost friendly lawsuits in certain districts. And it's been assigned to what's called multi-district litigation, meaning all these cases are eventually going to be heard by one court. It's also weird that we're in the Circuit Court of Appeals because that's sort of a function of the statute that the administration, OSHA, relied on in passing the temporary emergency standard or the rule. The way that works, it's actually in the statute that says, look, if you want to seek a stay, the first place you seek the stay is in your local court of appeals. So we're in a weird world because everything's in the court of appeals already. There are a bunch of these cases across the country. They're all going to be consolidated into one. The Fifth Circuit is the only one that's ruled so far. And I think it is on Tuesday where there is literally it's a lottery. They pick a circuit sort of from like a bin, right? That's actually how they do it. And that's like the winning circuit that's going to get where all these cases are going to be consolidated. So there's more to come. And so, for example, you could end up with if it's the Ninth Circuit that gets all these cases, them taking a different view of it. But the fact is the Fifth Circuit's opinion is out there now. So they're sort of first out of the gate and sort of set the tone for the continuing litigation. But it's going to be, there's a lot of like, you know, the, of your legal insider types, like me, who are going to be watching Tuesday when they pull the names out of the hat to see what court you go to. Now, again, regardless, it's going to go to the Supreme Court eventually. But I think that's just a, it's going to be an interesting, interesting to see what happens there.
I got to say, Jay, though, I would find it hard to believe that the majority of justices on the Supreme Court would not fully agree with the ruling here by the Fifth Circuit, at least with the logic, because
if they got you, I would say getting Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett should be no problem.
No, and you know, I want to make something clear: is that I am certainly a fan of vaccination, and I am certainly a fan of government doing whatever it can within its authority. to actually encourage and even, if possible, mandate vaccinations. And so this is one of these cases where I have a preferred policy outcome. And my preferred policy outcome would be if there is a way for the state to mandate vaccines, I am on balance okay with that. Though I recognize it's an imposition of freedom, I feel it's a permissible imposition on personal freedom under the circumstances. But I come away from this convinced that as a matter of law, both Congress's statute and constitutional law, that while this would have been permissible if it had been done by the individual states, I just can't see it as being permissible as being done by the federal government, really, in any instance. And I, you know, that's maybe regrettable, but I can't just change the Constitution and federalism and the statute just because there's a policy outcome I would like, you know. And so I think that's important.
That's why, and Mike, that's why I salute you for your intellectual honesty on these things. I mean, I think that's, I try to do the same, you know, when the shoe's on the other foot. But no, I think that's sort of the, to me, is the fundamental question here. Setting aside the bigger picture beyond the legalistics is, look, is this something that is the federal government's business? And I think you're exactly right on that. It's an overreach. Now, states have much broader police power generally over their citizens. And I would agree that a state could probably craft a vaccine mandate that would be more workable. Now again, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's necessarily constitutional, because there's plenty of ways states could screw that up, right?
But I mean, it seems to me we can kind of look at this in two ways. Number one, if we just put the constitutional issues aside and say, well, okay, let's take a look at OSHA's statutory authority here. And to be clear, this is not a regular rule. This is something called an emergency temporary standard that allows an agency, in this case OSHA, to skip the typical like 6 month long review and comment process before any rule is put into place. It's just saying this is so important that we can't take comments. We can't go through the normal review process for every other rule. And so therefore the standard for allowing that is much higher. It has to be under extraordinary circumstances. And what the court found,
I think grave danger
of harm.
That failure to adopt this standard would pose a grave danger to the people. I think it's grave danger.
And the point being made here by the court is that, well, certainly we're not saying that COVID is not a grave danger in general, but if you look at the rule and what the rule is addressing, there's not enough here to determine that there is a specific grave danger, not just of exposure, but of actual harm, especially as they point out in the decision, with like 78% or more of the population 12 and above vaccinated. That standard, maybe that would be a different conclusion if this were a regular rule, but it's not. It's an ETS, and so that standard is higher. And they say, well, it doesn't meet that standard just by that ground. And kind of related to this is, if you take a look at the nature of the rule itself, it makes no determination. It makes no distinguishing between different types of jobs. All it says is 100 or more. And as the court points out in the opinion, saying, well, there's a pretty big difference in terms of grave danger if you are, say, a long-haul trucker in a company with more than 100 or more employees, or if you are, the other example you have is a janitor in a prison. And so in that sense, they find that just in how the statute is constructed or the regulation is constructed, it's overly broad and kind of related to that to say, but on the same token, they say, well, we're only applying this to 100 or more. Why? Well, because, well, we think businesses with under 100 people wouldn't be able to necessarily implement that. And so the court says, well, wait a second. So that sort of goes and pushes back against your idea right. that there's a grave danger here. Because
it's a grave, if it's a, yeah, there's a, yeah, there's a great line where the judge says that, you know, a worker who has 99 coworkers would face a grave danger. Well, they co-worker with only 98 co-workers would not.
Exactly. And so, again, we're going to post the link to this opinion because it's only 22 pages. And if you don't read the footnotes, it's quicker than that. And like I said, it convinced me. And not only that, but I feel like I said to Jay before the show, is I wish they gave this opinion as an example to all new federal judges to say, this is how you write stuff, because it was clear, concise, compelling, and just, you know, it was not the decision I would have hoped for on policy grounds, but it certainly convinced me just in terms of the quality of the logic and argument. So that's the regulatory sort of OSHA's regulatory authority. But the second thing I wanted to bring up was the constitutional argument, because I wasn't actually expecting that. And they at the beginning of the opinion, they said, well, we don't really have to get into that here because it's so bad for other reasons. But they do actually get into it, because normally the argument is, well, Congress can regulate on this or allow or give this regulatory authority to agencies based on its commerce a power, right? Just saying that, well, this is part of regulating commerce between the states. But the court here argues that, well, not necessarily in this instance, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, so as most people or very frequent listeners or people who are into this kind of thing know, commerce has come to mean just about most anything, right? In some ways can be related to commerce and therefore open to federal regulation. And there are some very few exceptions, but this would be one of them. And interestingly, the judge actually cites to the Sebelius case, ACC case, mm-hmm. and or ACA case, for that look, there's no actual interstate commerce going on here between what an employer does for their own workers within that state, and I think that's sort of exactly right, that they're taking the broader piece. That look, even if Congress had enacted a statute that was broad enough to permit this, it would still be unconstitutional because it would be an overreach of Congress's yeah. commerce power.
You know, I think it might have been from that case where they quote they cite Justice Roberts in his concurrence, and he writes, and I thought it's really kind of brought it home to me, this argument. Wrote that Roberts wrote, people for reasons of their own often fail to do things that would be good for them or good for society. Those failures, joined with the similar failures of others, can readily have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Under the government's logic, that authorizes Congress to use its commerce power to compel citizens to act as the government would have them act. So in other words, you could say that, well, certainly it would be indirectly better for interstate commerce if people were healthier, if they ate less red meat, if they ate less animal fats, if they didn't smoke, if they didn't, you know, if they lost weight, what have you. And so under that logic, all of those things have an indirect effect on interstate commerce. So therefore, the government could pass a regulation saying that you either have a BMI of X or you have to do weekly weigh-ins or something like that. And that would be the same sort of logic. And clearly, in that instance, that, you know, that would be no one would. Well, there are some people who might be okay with that, but most people wouldn't be okay with that.
It goes to that, you know, the what is the limiting principle?
Yeah.
And that's sort of what if Congress can say that it has the power to intrude on, this would be a very personal health decision. What can Congress not legislate on? And if that's the case, then listen, aren't we, you know, if the entire premise of our Constitution is that the federal government is one of limited powers, limited and enumerated powers, you know, that kind of all goes out the window. So I think that's, again, a great, and I'm always happy. And a little bit, Mike, if I'm an absolute purist on sort of opinion writing and sort of what they call the Brandeis rules and stuff, I mean, maybe I don't get to that Commerce Clause question.
Right.
But that what I'm referring to is there's sort of a general sense of, for most courts, look, if you don't have to reach a constitutional issue, then you don't, right? If you can decide it just on the statute, there's no way to get in the Constitution. Now, of course, on this, where it is a temporary stay and they're sort of evaluating a possibility of success on the merits, you can sort of take a broader scope, right, and say, well, look, on any, you know, potential reading, and even if assuming Congress had this power, or you were to say that the statutory you know, claim would fail, or would succeed, that the statute was authorized, we would still say that the statute was unconstitutional.
Right.
So, you give them a bigger strike zone there, but no, you're absolutely right.
And again, I'll probably get some pushback. Well, you know, Mike isn't a real liberal in that sense.
Why are you for the unvaccinated?
But again, yeah. I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, it's important to not start from, we'll say, well, what is the result I want? And then work backward and sort of support the logic that, or the lack thereof, right, that gives me that result. And I think both on the right and the left, there's far too much of that. And so we'll see all of the predictable responses, both from the right and the left. And the vast majority of those responses will be like, well, this is the final result I wanted. And just, you know, the reasoning is just, you know, unimportant, essentially, because what I want is what, yeah, I should get. And that is, you know, that to me is what's so deeply problematic about American political discourse, you know. So,
well, you know what, and what often troubles me, I think, on people on the right, and the fact that is so much, so often misunderstood about conservatism, yeah, is the sense of, you know, okay, here's something that is good for you. But then sort of the left, and I'm not saying you, but I'm saying others on the left in general, there's the sense of, well, look, if it's something good for you or good for society, well, we ought to make it mandatory. And that's where we sort of, you know, you know, there's that parting of the ways where there are plenty of, as you said, and as the judge points out, there's plenty of things that might be good for you, might be good for society, might be good for the health of the country in general. But that doesn't mean that the federal government has the power or ought to make them mandatory.
Yeah, and there's certainly a balance to be considered here. I think with all these things, it's not necessarily you know, one or the other. It's what's the extent of the potential harm that could be caused to society, and there's always that balancing. And I think as a general rule, you know, conservatives like you will tend to favor a little bit more liberty interests, and liberals more like myself will tend to favor, not to discount liberty interests, but certainly to favor interests of equality and what we believe to be social good a little bit more. And so it's not a one or the other type of situation, basically. But it seems like pretty clearly in this instance, it would be shocking if this OSHA rule ever goes into effect.
Agreed. Yes.
So there we have it with that. But, all right. Well, then why don't we first take just a very quick break, and then we will come back and talk about inflation, some not so great news. Okay, so Jay, you know, inflation continues to rise. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported this week that inflation in October was up 6.2% compared to a year ago. That's the biggest increase in, I believe, 31 years. Food, housing,
who could have predicted that, Mike?
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. Yeah. Now, food and housing and energy prices all rose, really. They kind of led that, with gasoline up right around 50% from a year earlier. And prices also rose nearly 1% from September to October. And that's the biggest one-month increase since the post-financial crisis recession over 12 years ago now. Now, the Federal Reserve continues to say that they expect inflation to be transitory. But politicians and now some economists are starting to wonder how transitory it actually is and when we might actually expect a return to something approaching pre-pandemic inflation numbers. Talking with reporters last week, Fed Chair Jay Powell said, "It's very difficult to predict the persistence of supply constraints or their effects on inflation. Global supply chains are complex. They will return to normal function, but the timing of that is highly uncertain." And just a few days ago, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin tweeted, "By all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to the American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse. From the grocery store to the gas pump, Americans know the inflation tax is real, and D.C. can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans feel every day." Now, Manchin gets, well, that tweet gets at least two things wrong. Number one, it's not record inflation in the larger sense, but okay, I'll give him a pass on that. But it's definitely not true that, by all accounts, inflation is not transitory. In fact, still by most accounts, most economists believe the opposite, even if they're somewhat less confident in their predictions of how long this transitoriness will be than they were a few months ago. But
The dark ages were transitory.
Yeah, but let me just say, now, when it comes to inflation, perception can matter a lot. And Jay, you in particular have pointed this out previously on the show, because if enough people believe prices are going to continue rising, they're likely to stock up now on whatever they can to avoid those future price hikes, which in turn can cause prices to rise, making inflation, at least to a certain degree, a certain extent, possibly a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is why I have such a problem with the fear-mongering, what I see as fear-mongering from people like Joe Manchin. I feel that's highly irresponsible, but that's we can get into that. So, Jay, I'm pretty sure I know how you feel about these latest inflation numbers, and I could just feel the self-congratulatoriness sort of seeping through here.
I'm saddened, but also triumphant. I think something else that Jerome Powell did not mention, which is, you can read your own thing into this about saying, well, this is, supply chain issues. Yes and no. I think some of the supply chain issues are certainly contributing to it, but as is, almost a year and a half of zero interest rates and pumping $1 billion into the economy, that's a lot of it too. And I think it's,
I want to talk about that, because the Fed's position for a while now, since the pandemic started, is that, first off, they took short-term interest rates down to effectively zero. And they have said for a long time now that they don't want to raise interest rates until the labor market is back to its pre-pandemic trajectory. And we're getting there, certainly. The latest jobs report looked really good, and they have been looking good for a while, but we're not there yet. Now, earlier this month, a few weeks ago, they announced that they'd begin tapering down their monthly treasury bond and mortgage bond purchases. And so that's what the Fed does. It's called quantitative easing.
It's actually how they change interest rates.
Yeah. Well, it changes longer-term interest rates, because when they take short-term rates down to zero, they can't go lower than zero on that. Well, you can't. It gets kind of complex. But anyway,
monetary policy. Yeah,
they buy treasury bonds and mortgage bonds. What do they buy them with? Well, they just create money, basically, to buy them with. And to give you a sense of how big of a deal this is, since the beginning of the pandemic, every single month, the Fed has been purchasing $80 billion in treasury bonds and $40 billion in mortgage bonds. That's $120 billion every month. And this is, again, in addition to having those short-term interest rates at effectively zero. And so that is a huge fiscal stimulus. And this is why, kind of circling around to Build Back Better, when you think about the size of the stimulus that the Fed is injecting compared to the decade-long price tag for Build Back Better, the Fed has a lot more ability to very quickly put the brakes on this than anything Congress is doing or considering doing. And so that to me, in a sense, is why I have a big problem with where Joe Manchin is going on this. Now, I think Manchin is just saying the things he's saying so he gives himself cover for potentially voting against the Build Back Better. So that's maybe a political thing. But the Fed has done an awful lot to prop up the economy. And I think that, you know, they're doing the right thing in pumping the brakes a little bit here.
Yeah, I would have, you know, again, we had this conversation a while back, and I would have been pumping the brakes 6 months earlier. At least. And again, I'm not a con. What should I be? The M1, right, Mike? That's the money supply, I think, is how it works with economists, if I remember correctly. And there was always this debate, right, in your academic circles, in your economy circles, of what matters more. Is it monetary policy or is it fiscal policy in terms of this, in terms of inflation and heating and stimulating the economy? And, you know, look, that's sort of a how many angels can dance on the head of a pin type question when we're, you know, or a, you know, tastes great, less filling type answer is that they both do it. But regardless of what the Fed's doing, you know, I don't know that anyone would say, look, I guess. So here's the thing. I guess I could say, listen, I could, if I'm in Congress and wanted to pass a big spending increase, I can make the argument of, look, the Fed's got really tight money at this point. They're not doing anything. The Fed is, you know, strangling the economy. This was sort of an argument that Trump made, is the Fed wasn't relaxing interest rates quickly enough. You know, therefore, we ought to do more in terms of fiscal policy to stimulate the economy. But when the Fed's been going full bore all this time, I think it's sort of an argument that another reason why you don't need more expending on the fiscal side.
Yeah.
So,
well, and just to put this in the context, you know, I think, well, if you look at Build Back Better, it's right now it's at $1.7 trillion, right? Over 10 years. And now that's not to say that it's equally spread out. They're going to try to, I'm sure, the front load to extent that you can, but you divide obviously that by 10 and you get $170 billion per year. And number one, in an economy with a GDP of nearly 21 trillion, that's just over 0.8%. So, and that would be smaller every year in the future as the economy grows. But I think it's important to point out that $170 billion, that's considerably less than the Fed has been injecting into the economy every 2 months. So, I mean, these are two.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong on that, right?
Yeah.
That the Fed has been doing a whole lot. I'm saying, you know, almost, well, because the Fed has been doing so much, or some might argue too much. We ought not to.
I guess what I'm saying is that
fiscal path. I'm saying, you know, yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is that if one is otherwise for Build Back Better, this would not be an argument that I think, if one's being honest, would tilt one saying, well, we shouldn't do it. Now, I think it's perfectly understandable that people who are against it just already and who would be against it under any circumstances would say, oh yeah, and it might contribute to inflation, but I think that's an incredibly weak argument, certainly. And that's what I'm getting. Okay. So, yeah. but, you know, and I think, Joe, you're being a little more intellectually honest than, say, Joe Manchin, who, again, I think is just desperately looking for any reason to not support this. And he's really happy that he has this. So, you know, and so I was thinking about this, saying, well, what could we do?
I don't know. I would say I don't know that you have to be desperate to look for reasons, but.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, on policy grounds, you're saying, and that's where you and I disagree on that. We've talked about that before. But, you know, it's clear to me that, well, what could you do? What can Democrats do to get the most reluctant Democrat, right, in the Senate, Joe Manchin, to go along? And I thought, well, you know what? There's actually nothing that would prevent Congress from, say, for the Senate from or Congress from passing this legislation and saying, but it will only go into effect at X date, because Congress passes legislation that has a, you know, effect date of whatever all kinds of times into the future and say, and only if inflation is under X percent. Now, they've never done anything like that before, as far as I can tell from my research into this. But that would certainly answer Manchin's concerns. He'd find another reason, I think, to not support it. But the big thing is, I think if you're being incredibly cautious, you can make an argument to say, well, why don't we wait 6 months, whatever, six, eight months to see how this plays out? And I get that argument. I don't think it's a good argument. Now, politically, it's a horrible argument for Democrats for a number of reasons. Number one is, you know, there are six Democratic senators over the age of 70 in states where the governor is a Republican and could appoint a replacement if a senator retires or dies in office. You know, and in a 60-50-50 Senate, that's a consideration. And not only that, but two of those Democrats are 80 or older, both from Vermont, weirdly, where I guess they like to just elect old Democratic senators. But, you know, and also as you get closer to the midterm elections, you're going to find more Democrats, more centrist Democrats becoming, I think, a little more uncomfortable with this thing. So, you know, the political and policy timelines don't necessarily line up. And so I think
the window is closing.
Yeah, the window is closing. Exactly. So there's that. But I got to say, I am becoming, you know, I have said that I think something will pass. I still think on balance that that is going to happen. But I am a lot less confident in that than I was even a few weeks ago, given what Manchin has been signaling. So I'm not entirely sure about that now. But I want to.
I think the inflation numbers do play into this, just in terms of people looking at this proposal and seeing, regardless of if you want to say the impact of the Fed is bigger. The impact of monetary policy has more to do with inflation than fiscal policy. Fine, but I think people are not wrong to say, as I was kind of pointing out, that look, if we are, let's say we're 6% year over year right now, see where we are once we get through the holidays, and this is a time when people do a lot of spending, a lot of shopping, and they're going to be saying, geez. There's I'm paying a whole lot more than I did last year. Is the remedy, what we need is the federal government to inject more money. I think there's a very good argument to say that no, whatever impact that may have, even if it's dwarfed by the Fed, that's not a good thing. You know, it's sort of like, well, only throw a little bit of gasoline on the fire.
Yeah. And
it still is just not a, yeah.
Yeah. But I think we on the left don't really look at it as injecting money into the economy, which just sounds like a kind of a weird, you know, stupid kind of thing to do. Not stupid necessarily, but we look at it as making it just dramatic and transformative in some cases, semi-transformative changes in terms of social policy. And so
how is that done?
Well, it's done through obviously, you know, through spending money. You have to spend this money. But you got to remember that a lot of this is paid for through higher taxes. So it's not like this is all just borrowing.
The best of both worlds.
Well, I mean, taxing people who can afford. I certainly think it's the best of both worlds. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so the issue that this might have an incredibly mild inflationary effect when the Fed still has a ton of tools in its toolkit, the Fed is just stomped on the gas pedal as hard as it can. Say, oh my God, we're speeding. So we'll just pull off the gas pedal. You don't have to stop in its tracks. Very positive, transformative social policy changes because of this. And so that's why I think that, you know, from the left, we just don't see this as a very viable argument at all. But I want to come back to the inflation part, because that baseline number is concerning. Anyone should be concerned, especially given that it seems that inflation has spread beyond some of these sort of really core type of supply chain things into some other sectors. But I still think there are good reasons to think that this is still transitory. And one of them is what's called the trimmed mean PCE inflation measure, which is a measure of inflation that the Dallas Fed developed a while ago. And their research has shown that this is actually a better indicator of long-term inflation trends than that headline number that we quote of the 6.2%. And right now, this measure of inflation basically, as the name suggests, it trims out the most extreme price rises and drops, because what past research over decades and decades has shown is that these are often the result of one-off factors and not a sign of underlying inflation. And typically what happens then is those unusual events create short-term spikes, but within around a year or so, headline inflation and this mean PCE, trimmed mean PCE inflation converge. And right now, the latest measure of the trimmed mean PCE inflation is 2.3%. Now, that's for September. It's probably going to be a little higher in October. But given the research on this, it seems to me that this is at least a reasonably robust indicator that what we're seeing is, in fact, transitory. And within a year or so, we can expect to see headline inflation and this trimmed mean PCE converge somewhere in the below, you know, between 2% and 3% level. And I think that, to me, that's exactly, you know, what you would expect. Although, again, granted, that time period is longer than a lot of folks expected. But this is, while this is a one-off event, COVID, let's hope it's a one-off event, it's one of the sort of scope that we've never seen before.
Well, I guess my issue so often with experts is that so often they're wrong. I mean, if you look at what Powell was suggesting back at the beginning of the year, when we were talking about, well, inflation is just transitory, he was talking about in terms of months, right? That, oh, that once, you know, in the summer, this will all be straightened out, and we're looking at a yearly inflation probably around 2.5. That's what we're shooting for. And he was nowhere close. I think you're
somewhat mischaracterizing. And also, I want to say that, you know, I think it is.
That's been the Fed's stated goal, though, right?
No, that's their goal, certainly.
And it's 2.5, yeah, which we're working on. And
I think this argument that, or it's maybe not your argument, and maybe you're just exaggerating for effect, saying the thing about experts is that they're so often wrong. And the implication there is that, well, experts are wrong more than they're right. And it seems to me, and I think this is a big problem, especially on the right. I certainly accept that some folks would just say, well, we just have to follow the experts blindly because they're always right.
Right.
I disagree with that. But this idea that experts are wrong more than they're right, and that's what, at least from what I heard
Pushing, I'm pushing back on the argument. And part of this comes up because that was sort of one of those questions on the little test we took.
Yeah, the Buchan, yeah.
Pushing back on the government by expertise and well, shut up, that guy's an expert.
I'm not saying that.
I think we ought not. I'm arguing that, yeah, experts should not be followed blindly, especially when they're in political positions. Jerome Powell certainly has a whole lot more economic expertise. He's forgotten more about economics than I've ever learned. But he's also a political actor, and that's why.
Someone like
Fauci, right? Again, he knows certainly more about medicine than I do. But I'm against accepting the idea that, well, this person's an expert, and therefore this is, the question is settled.
Me too. I agree with you there. What I was kind of arguing against is this notion, again, and this is not an uncommon notion, saying that, well, experts are wrong more often than they're right. And I think that is just flat out incorrect. And I think it's dangerous because it just suggests that, well, expertise, we can just ignore expertise. And in fact, the experts, if the elites are saying one thing, well, then we should just do the other thing because they're right.
No, I'm not suggesting a reflexive of anytime someone with a degree or some level of expertise says something that we ought to assume they're wrong. I'm suggesting they're human.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. They're not infallible. There's no question. And especially when we're talking about complex systems, I totally agree with you on that. So given all that, though, what do you think about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of history to suggest that this trimmed mean PCE is actually a more accurate indication of inflation trends over time, and that it is, you know, considerably lower. Certainly, you're not going to completely discount.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But I, what I, what I discount and I'm sort of poking fun at is the idea of transitory, in that back, you know, again, at the beginning of the year, the sense was, well, transitory means a couple months, and now transitory means a year or two. And I think it's completely foreseeable that come next summer, well, when we said transitory, we mean 2 or 3 years.
That would be stretching the meaning of transitory.
Goalpost moving, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that.
And that's, you know, and again, it's the experts who are saying this. And as I said last week's show, I mean, look, at, you know, in the big picture, everything's transitory, right? But that doesn't mean that you might have a couple of years that really suck.
No, and I think anything over a year, that would be not the definition of transitory anymore, at least. And also, I should say that Dallas, the Dallas Fed research suggests that that headline inflation and this trend mean PCE, they should converge within around a year or so. And so, again, if you start looking out multiple years, no, that's not transitory. That's like a longer term trend. And I agree with you on that. So, you know, but one thing I will point out is it's positive news, I think, in a sense, or could be seen as positive, is now we talked about this a few weeks ago. Wages are definitely way up, but they're not keeping pace with inflation. But on the positive end, assuming that this is transitory in a real sense, right, the way we are seeing it, wages tend to be stickier than prices. Right. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing when wages don't keep up with prices, because what I mean by stickier is that you don't get to renegotiate your salary every week or every month, where prices can kind of go up and down like that. But if you can get higher wages locked in, well, then they're stickier on the upside as well. And so if this is transitory, well, that might mean there'll be at least some wage gains that will be, at least for a while, locked in. And I think that's a positive thing, at least potentially.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on the wage piece being stickier than a price piece. So, yeah, I guess that's good. The other, and this is something I read, and it was this morning in The Intercept, which I thought was just kind of hilarious, about the how inflation's really good for everybody, where it's good for the 99%, is that by diminishing the value of money, it essentially diminishes the amount of debt you might owe.
Yeah, good for borrowers.
To the 1%.
Yeah.
And which is a really clever argument, and I think, you know, you can, it would be great to try to explain that to somebody at the grocery store. So,
I mean, it's, you know, again, it's, there are the prices that you see every day, the things you see, whether it's a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk or something like that. But then if you, you know, if you are somebody who has a home mortgage for hundreds of thousands of dollars, well, that might not be a price or a savings you see every day because of inflation in that sense, but it is likely to dwarf the cost of, say, your yearly milk purchases, unless you're like that one family with five, like 16 gallons of milk a week or something like that. It's just weird. Right. But yeah, so I mean, and I think that's I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because of course that is clearly behind this notion for government should do something, because those are the prices that you see literally with the gas prices, you know, in big numbers, you know, when you're just driving down the street all the time. And so, but of course that in a way is a deeply unconservative notion, right? That, well, there is a problem, so therefore government should do something about this, and of course you.
No, my whole point is government should do less about all of it, and you will see inflation go back to a normal, healthy sort of, because there is something as a healthy inflation. If you have a growing economy,
around 2%,
there's going to be inflation, and you need that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I still just to recall back for listeners that a while ago, in fact, about a month ago, Jay and I made inflation predictions, and I will just repeat those here. My prediction, and I will stick to both my predictions. I know Jay will stick to his, certainly. But I said that by roughly mid-April of 2022, that headline inflation number compared to a year back will be under 4%, and that by mid-July of 2022, it'll be under 3%. And I'll stick with that. You will stick, I am sure, with your belief that both of those numbers will be higher.
Yeah, so, I would say 5% at least. So on both those numbers,
we will see. Absolutely. All right. Well, then let's move on. On Thursday, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals blocked the release of Trump White House records to the House January 6th committee, and they fast-tracked oral arguments for November 30th, so just a few weeks from now. Now, the three judges on the D.C. Circuit panel issuing the unanimous ruling, I should point out, were all Democratic appointees, two Obama appointees and one Biden appointee. In their brief order, the appeals court wrote, "The purpose of this administrative injunction is to protect the court's jurisdiction to address appellant's claim of executive privilege and should not be construed in any way as a ruling on the merits." Now, this followed a ruling earlier in the week from Federal District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan, who rejected Trump's request to enjoin the release of the requested documents by the committee. And in her ruling, Judge Chutkan argued that the decision to invoke executive privilege rests with the sitting president, who, in her words, is best situated to protect executive branch interests. The incumbent has the information and attendant duty of executing the laws in light of current facts and circumstances. And only the incumbent remains subject to political checks against abuse of that power. Further, she cited the Supreme Court precedent in United States versus Reynolds, in which the court concluded that executive privilege belongs to the government and must be asserted by it. It can neither be claimed nor waived by a private party, as Donald Trump is at this point. However, though, she also noted that the court has found privilege survives the end of a president's term, and that in Nixon versus GSA, the court concluded that ensuring that the president can have full and frank discussion with advisors cannot be measured by the president's tenure, or the few months after a president's tenure, or even years. On the other hand, though, in the same ruling, the court wrote, "The incumbent president is vitally concerned with and in the best position to assess the present and future needs of the executive branch and to support invocation of the privilege accordingly." So it's pretty clear here we have two sort of competing things here. And so, Jay, what do you think about these competing arguments, and where would you come down if you were, you know, if you were being asked to rule on this?
So I think the district court judge, everything you just quoted, I think that's exactly right. And I think the Court of Appeals did exactly the right thing as well. And if that seems to be contradictory, my sense is she is probably right that executive privilege belongs to the current executive. I think as that the Supreme Court language indicates, there is some holdover, right? For a period of time, that I think is appropriate, and that's a tough call to make, right? And that's going to be sort of a fact intensive inquiry. But I think the Court of Appeals is entirely right to stay this, just from the legal sense, right? This is one of those cases where we talk about irreparable harm, and big irreparable harms in the law is, well, waiving of a privilege, because the idea is once that's done, the bell can't be unrung. So it makes sense, especially if you're dealing with a big question like this, executive privilege, and a big question that will likely go up to the Supreme Court, to, you know, not just rule hastily, but okay, let's brief it, let's have oral arguments, because there's essentially There's no harm done if we wait a couple more months to get a more fleshed out decision versus if we were to erroneously declare that there is no privilege or here's the scope of the privilege, and then that bell can't be unrung.
Yeah, because once those documents are out, I think
those courts get it right.
Yeah, I agree. So, and I think when we talk about the harm, I think a lot of folks are focusing on the harm to Donald Trump, and they're like, well, anything that harms Donald Trump
is to the president.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I think hasn't been emphasized enough, is that, yes, there would certainly be irreparable harm potentially to Donald Trump, and yay, you know, okay, I'm all for that. But there's also the potential chilling effect on the current and future presidencies, because if they see this ruling saying, well, you know, these things aren't necessarily going to be covered by executive privilege or only until the moment that I stop being president, well, yeah. What yeah. does
well,
that have well, a chilling?
Well, one on January 20th, it's all coming out. Yeah.
Yeah. So my point is that if, for people who think this is a no-brainer, easy decision, it's not really, because it is important that there's a reason why executive privilege exists. And I think there's a good case to be made that it just doesn't go away because a president ends his term of office, because you have to think about the whole point of executive privilege, right? And that is to allow for that sort of free exchange of information between a president and his or her advisors. And so if there's precedent saying that, well, yeah, it's fine as long as you're president, but once you're out of office, it's all fair game, how could that not potentially have a chilling effect? Now, you need to weigh that against, you know, what's being considered and what the legislative purpose of Congress is in asking for these documents, and the nature of, is this a criminal inquiry or things like that. And so I agree with you that both courts, it seems to me, got this right. But this is not a simple case. And I think people who think it is either way are dramatically oversimplifying the sort of competing values that are at stake here.
Yeah. And executive privilege is, like many privileges, a qualified privilege, which means it's not like a blanket, I'm the executive, everything I say, do is privileged. It's privileged except for certain circumstances, or it's privileged in certain circumstances. And so there is a weighing and a factual inquiry for the courts to kind of draw a line of, well, this is privileged. For example, Watergate, there was the question about executive privilege in the tapes. And the court said, no, those are not subject to executive privilege and were eventually released or able to be subpoenaed. But I think they would have drawn the line on, can you depose a president, right? On executive privilege. I think there's a, again, there's lines to be drawn, and it's more, as you say, more complicated than just Trump bad,
right?
Or a yes, there's privilege, no, there's not privilege, because these decisions, one, you're setting it up for whatever the Supreme Court's gonna do eventually, but two, it's going to affect, as you said, a lot of how presidents and the executive branch govern themselves, you know, rightly or wrongly. So it sounds weird to say. I think the district judge is probably, at the end of the day, right on the merits. But I think the Court of Appeals is right on, let's think it through before we get there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the Biden administration sort of weighed the benefits of transparency in this clearly, I would say, extraordinary instance, but that against that chilling effect, and ended up making what I see as the right call to not assert privilege. But I don't expect it was like the easiest call in the world for the Biden administration to make, given, you know, our discussion of this. And in fact, we had talked earlier about privilege in the Biden administration in this context, and we sort of thought, well, we're not really sure what they would necessarily do because of this sort of tension. But I also get why House Democrats are upset, because they're expecting.
They want the stuff now.
Oh, yeah. The now, right? They are expecting that these documents will be damaging to Trump and also to others who communicated with him on January 6th, including some congressional Republicans. And now, even assuming—
They need it for the midterms.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, because if you look at the timeline, right, even assuming that the appeals court ends up agreeing with the district court judge in the end, this goes to the Supreme Court. And, you know, I can't imagine the Supreme Court, you at least can see an instance where the Supreme Court doesn't issue their own final ruling until, I don't know, maybe sometime in the summer. And that gives the committee a lot less time to work with, like you said, before the midterms. And also kind of complicating this, House Democrats have to know that it's highly unlikely that January 6th committee is going to be in place after January of 2023, because I think it's unrealistic for them to expect that they're going to be in control of the House of Representatives. And so if they only get access to those records, say, in June of 2022, and they also have to focus on their own midterm elections, that doesn't give them a whole lot of time to do the work that they want to do. And so that's why the push for this sort of thing, and these sort of record requests can take an awful long time. And certainly Republicans, or Trump supporters at least, are hoping that they'll be able to run out the clock on this. And I think there's a reasonably good chance that that's at least to a certain extent going to be what's going to happen.
Well, there's also something in politics that is really important that often doesn't get considered when the media is talking about stuff, or you don't hear about the news, and that's momentum. And sort of the short-term memory span of the electorate. If we are into next summer and talking about what happened on January 6th, there are a whole lot of people who, unless that story has been in front of them, unless it's been put out continually, this is a big issue, are going to start, that's going to recede in their memories, right? Rightly or wrongly, you can say it should or it shouldn't, but I think it will. And more particularly, I think a lot of folks may say, as I predict, next summer, of why the hell am I paying $5 a gallon for gas? And we're talking about what Trump said or didn't say a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
2 years ago. I think that's just, and that's just the political reality of it.
Yeah. And I agree. I think one lesson we talked about last week that Democrats might want to take away from those recent elections is that don't run against Trump if Trump isn't on the ballot. That's not necessarily going to be a winning strategy. So that might make a lot more sense in 2024 if he ends up being the nominee, but not so much for the midterms.
He is, as they say, transitory, Mike.
Oh, let's hope so. Let's hope so. I think you're wrong, but I've never helped you or right on anything, I don't think, more than this. But anyway, on that note, we kind of reached the end of our time here for the regular show. We still have a lot to talk about on our supporter bonus show. We want to get into the federal judge ruling that the Texas mask mandate ban is not okay because of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Some pretty rough situations that House Republicans, the 13 House Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill, are facing. And also, I think we'll surely have time to get into a new university that's a pretty intriguing, interesting sort of prospect. We'll talk about that and maybe that Pew political typology survey that Jay referred to earlier. All that's on the bonus show. If you are a supporter, that will be in your feed when you hear that. And if you're not a supporter, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys and you can become one. Or if you would like to get that bonus show and you can't afford to support the show, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, that doesn't cost anything. It really helps us out. As well as ratings and reviews. If you can leave those on the podcast app of your choice, it makes a big difference. And finally, sharing your favorite episodes, social media, that also helps out a lot, and really quick and easy and costs nothing. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find links to our Facebook and Twitter in the show notes. A special thanks, as always, to our most excellent executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.